Hello and welcome to Asians Represent. I'm Daniel Kwan.
And I'm Agatha Chang.
And we're your hosts.
Today is the first part of our arc, two-parter arc, Learning Through Play, where we talk about how RPGs help us learn.
Yeah, and today's guest is a special one because this is our first international guest.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, our guest is Kyril Hisham. So Kyril is a sci-fi and fantasy artist. He's an RPG dad. He's a teacher who lives in Malaysia. And Kyril and I kind of got in touch with each other almost, I think, over or close to a year ago when I found out that he teaches English and uses RPGs as a tool in his classroom at the university level. So we recorded an amazing episode, and I'm really excited about the conversation that you're about to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So Agatha, what's new?
Well, we went to SkyCon.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun, and someone came late.
That someone was me. Yeah, we went there, and the panel didn't happen.
Yeah, the panel didn't happen. I think there was a mess up with signage or something.
Yeah.
But the D&D happened with the broadswords.
Snap. Oh, did it happen?
Oh my God, they're the best.
Yeah, that was such a fun game. So we had our live show with the broadswords. Do, 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 do.
Yeah, just throwing those air horns.
To a One Shot Network, what's up?
Yeah, they hooked that up.
Yeah, we played in a Victoria's game, and it's been a while since I played D&D. And,
I think that was your first time playing 5th edition D&D.
Oh, for sure, yeah. Last time I played it was 4th ed, so, you know, that's...
With your boyfriend's family?
Yes, yeah.
Or, I would say, fiancé's family.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a really fun collaboration.
Yeah.
Like, your character was Piffle?
Piffle the Fighter.
Piffle the Fighter.
The Gnome Fighter. That's what's up.
The Gnomon Fighter. And I was Fizzbang the Human Monk.
Jeez.
And together we are Pizzle.
No, we're just Piz.
Piz. We're Piz. That's
we were
right.
Dubbed Piz by Victoria.
And I think that's what we have to run with from now on.
Yeah, we're the Piz duo.
Yeah, we're the Piz. Oh, God.
So gross.
Oh, God, so gross. But we had a lot of fun. It was a hilarious session. And I wish we had recorded the audio from that, because I think that would have been a fantastic.
There were so many
episode
highlights. What did we do?
I used Flurry of Blows to propel a raft very slowly with my kicks.
Yeah, so it was like a ship race, and we were supposed to build a ship in time, or even like fix a raft, but we couldn't do it because we kept on failing rolls. So what we had was a mast, but it wasn't connected to the raft, so someone had to hold the mast while you were doing your kicks to
it was,
power it.
My dump stat was intelligence, so I had a minus 8 intelligence.
Honestly, I think realistically, all of
not
our...
Not minus 8, sorry. I had an 8 intelligence, which is minus 1.
I think all of our dump stats were intelligence from how that went.
It was really, really funny.
Yeah.
It was hilarious.
Yeah, and we got third in that race.
Yeah, there were only 4 boats, and 2 of them were by us.
No, there were 5.
Or 5?
Because we beat 2.
That's remember? Right, you're right. No,
yeah.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah, one of those was pretending
was
to
ours
be one other person.
Yeah, that was a fun episode. So
yeah.
I mean, shout out to the broadswords. We're going to be collaborating with them again in the future.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
I am really, really, really looking forward to that.
Yeah, Piz gonna be back.
Yeah, Piz gonna be back.
No one can stop us.
And I think, speaking of Piz, one of the things that we realized over dinner with in Kitchener was that we have a Discord.
Yeah,
yeah. We didn't. I guess we didn't realize that we could join the One Shot Network's Discord, mm-hmm. and there is an Asians Represent like tab on there.
Mm-hmm.
Is it called? I only use Discord.
Like channel?
Is it a channel?
I think so.
Because I use Discord up until like a week ago.
Yeah.
I've only used Discord to talk to my Overwatch friends. And then that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I barely used it either. I didn't know it was basically like Slack.
Yeah, basically the same thing. So we now know that there is an Asians Represent channel on the One Shot Network's Discord. And we plan on doing a lot with that.
Yeah. So before, when we checked it, we were like, oh, people have been commenting on
there. Yeah, people have been talking.
And we were like, whoops. But now we're manning it.
Yeah. We're personing it.
Man and woman.
Yeah, there we go. Inclusion. Yeah. We're going to be there. We're going to be present. I have the Discord app on my phone.
Same.
And if you want to, if you're part of that One Shot Network Discord, you know, feel free to get in touch with us when you see on Discord the Daniel Kwan is now playing some sort of video game. Like, hit me up. Join me if you play those games.
Mm,
I play a lot of Rainbow Six Siege. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Overwatch.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the future, we're going to try to organize some sort of Asians Represent, like, online gathering of video games or something.
Yeah, that'd be super fun. First, I got to get good at Overwatch.
No, you don't have to.
May never happen.
It's okay. It's okay. You don't have to get good. You just have to have fun.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And SkyCon was our first piece of news. And that was really big for us because that was our first con as a duo representing mm-hmm. Asians Represent.
Mm-hmm.
Like, our first con was Gen Con, which is like that's a giant con.
Yeah.
But you weren't able to be there.
No, I was not.
So SkyCon was our first con together, and that was a lot of fun.
Wow, we were great.
Like, totally worth it. Totally worth it.
Not to toot our own horns, but we were great.
I think we were great. I have another piece of news, and it kind of relates to the last episode of the podcast. I had the most amazing conversation with Daniel Fox.
Ooh.
Yeah. So our pal, I think it was our pal Fraser Simons, got on Twitter and was like, yo, have you seen this? And it was the announcement for that RPG Tetsubo by Grim and Perilous Studios, who are known for Zweihänder, the Emmy award-winning game Zweihänder. It's very cool.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the designer, Daniel, got in touch with me. And we started emailing back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really weird because it was like, hey, Daniel. Signed, Daniel. Oh, that's great, Daniel. It was really weird.
Mm-hmm. You're talking to yourself.
It was like I was talking to myself. But we had this, like, we were like, okay, let's have, like, an online meeting. And we talked on Discord. Well, go back to Discord.
Oh, yeah. Shout out to Discord.
I know. Discord's just making things happen. We talked on Discord for, like, 2 hours.
Wow.
About, you know, Japan and Orientalism and design and, you know, education and design.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're in talks for me to, like, kind of come on as a consultant for that project and, like, represent.
Yeah, that's good because they do need one.
Yeah. And then you and I are also going to be doing some sensitivity reading for another project I don't know if we could talk about yet.
Yeah. Yeah. It's in the works.
It's in the works, but we're making some changes.
Yeah.
We help in this world.
Yeah, we're going to keep doing it. So if you need our help as consultants, hire us.
or if you know any, you know, Asians or people who represent the communities you're trying to represent in your game, like, get in touch with them.
Because yes.
That was the message of last week's episode.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the message, not last week's, last month's episode.
Mm-hmm.
The message of that episode was, you know, we can't be gatekeepers of this hobby.
Yeah.
We can't say, oh, only Asians can write about Asia.
Yes.
That's not what we're trying to say. What we're trying to say is, if you want to ethically write about another person's culture or draw upon that culture for inspiration, for, you know, mass consumption, do your due diligence and do your research and make sure you talk to the right people. Now, we want to try a new segment in Asians Represent,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to be Questions and Answers with Agatha and Daniel.
Yes.
I'll think of a better name for that.
Do, 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 do.
But we have two questions this week.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one comes from actually the One Shot website, and it's from Gene Ha, like the Gene Ha.
Yep.
Like, oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It says, I'd love to hear you discuss upbringing in representation. Using the movie Crazy Rich Asians as an example, the mostly Asian American crew often had to be saved by Michelle Yeoh on cultural issues. At the first party at the family estate, Yeoh warned the crew that the white paper lanterns they'd strewn across the grounds were only used at funerals. She also worked hard to deepen her own character, which was reportedly a flat dragon lady stereotype in the book.
Mm.
So that's what we talked about last episode.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent do Asians raised in North America have the legitimacy to write about Asia? As a U.S.-born Korean-American, I wouldn't dare write a historical Korean setting for sale in Korea. There's just no way I'd get the nuances right. But it can be done. Most of the creative staff of the Black Panther movie were African-American raised in the U.S., and the movie is beloved across the whole continent of Africa, from Ethiopia to Nigeria to South Africa. This blows my mind. Wakanda is a fictional mashup of various African cultures, but they made it work and seem authentic to Africans. So what do you think of that, Agatha?
Yeah, I mean, I think the example, first of all, of Black Panther is really interesting because a huge theme in Black Panther is about I guess, the Black diaspora, or like, I guess, the African-American experience, which is like there's that struggle where you want to connect to your roots. And I think this was a huge thing that was happening around like from the 70s onwards, where there were a lot of people who wanted to kind of like go to Africa and to like explore their roots and find out their identities. And then they had like struggles with that. So I feel like that was a huge theme in Black Panther as well. And so I think a lot of the writers were drawing from that. And so that is a very authentically African-American experience or Black American experience. So that I think the nuance is a little bit different than if you're to say, oh, I'm just going to write about this specifically historical time within this country that I haven't actually lived in. I just am ethnically a part of that.
Right.
Yeah, but I have a very specific opinion about this, which is that anyone should be able to write about any culture. I know that we're always like, oh man, like the writer of this is like, they don't sound Asian or whatever. But that's kind of because there has been such a long and storied history of like people writing about cultures that they're not really familiar with and just kind of like doing whatever they want with it,
yeah,
and making it sound really terrible. But I think it's like everyone should have the creative license to choose something that they think is very interesting and write in it. But there's just like some things that you need to keep in mind when you're doing it. Like you need to do research. You need to do like enough research that you're like, I kind of am a little sick of this research. You know,
it's almost like you're doing something like it's almost academic.
Yeah, it's you got to put work into it, that kind of research. And then you should reach out to people from the community being like, hey, like, could you give me feedback on this? And then take the feedback. And yeah. I think the most important part of this is your attitude. So if people are like, even after it's published, if people are like, yo, I done read this and it's like, it's really problematic in this way.
Right.
If you have like the courage and humility to be like, oh, okay, I done goofed here. Like,
Let's fix this.
I acknowledge this. And if I can, you know, if we're going to do a reprint of it, then I'll fix it there.
Yeah.
That is really commendable.
Well, that's what happened, actually. So The Veil.
Yeah.
Like, good friend of mine, Fraser Simons, he mm-hmm. wrote a cyberpunk game
mm-hmm.
and uses the word, like the Japanese sort of term giri in it.
Mm-hmm.
And received a little bit of flack on that because it's you know, the use of Asian terms is kind of a trope in cyberpunk.
Yeah.
And he released a revised edition.
Yeah.
I'm kind of on the similar lines with you. And when the listeners kind of listen to the rest of this episode and they hear our interview with Kyrol,
mm-hmm.
they'll learn about this really interesting Malaysian world that he's developing for his home D&D game.
Oh my gosh,
like,
so cool.
We were like flipping out.
Yeah.
I might edit out the part where we're flipping out because we're kind of just like, oh my God, this is so cool.
Yeah, it's true. There was a lot of
us leaning into my computer trying to read along with him and like breathing very heavily into the mic.
Mm-hmm, true.
Nothing wrong with that. But he mentioned something really interesting. He said that he purposefully didn't set it in historical Malaysia and instead created something that was derivative of historical Malaysia so that he wouldn't have that outrage from people. He wouldn't create a work that could be perceived as problematic because he isn't a historian. When you make something that's derivative and fictional, you can take liberties with it.
Right.
And that's how I kind of feel about it. And also as somebody who is, you know, writing about Asians in gaming,
mm-hmm.
you know, I wasn't born in China Yeah. And I don't even speak Chinese that well.
Right.
I can say a couple of things really well, so well that people think I can speak Chinese better.
Mandarin, you mean?
Yeah, Mandarin Chinese.
Because Chinese is
okay, yeah, people will be like, oh, and I mean Mandarin. And like I have very poor linguistic skills.
Oh, okay.
But it doesn't mean that I can't, you know, write about Asians. I can't represent my community. Because one of the things that I like to say, and I talked about this in an article that I'm writing for Gnome Stew, and it's that like this podcast, like Asians Represent, and all of us in the community, all of us who were watching Asians in media, like mm-hmm. you know, with like the Joy Luck Club
mm-hmm.
And Hook,
yeah.
things like that.
Yeah,
the Asian community is very much a reactive force, right? Mm-hmm. We're reacting to Oriental adventures. We're reacting to, you know, these problematic games or these yeah. problematic movies and yeah. problematic depictions of Asians.
Yeah.
But one of the things we need to go get away from is like we can be reactive, but we also need to be active. We need to be creators,
mm-hmm.
right? It's like participate or be underrepresented. Right? It's like tell our stories or remain invisible.
Yeah, and also at the same time, yeah, it's like if you don't tell that story, someone else may tell it. Someone else who's may feel like they're even less like they
less qualified.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's just like by us, you know, creating, we're not creating on behalf of mainland Asians.
Mm-hmm.
We're not creating on behalf of Asians anywhere, mm-hmm. right? Because I can only speak for, you know, China,
mm-hmm.
right? I'm creating on behalf of the Chinese Canadian experience mm-hmm. and my perspective. So I'm acting with my dollars and buying projects and buying books and games that I think represent me well, but I'm also acting with my own creative muscles by, you know, making something that I want on the market and by enabling like and by like making this podcast, we're enabling people, we're inspiring people to go out and create.
Yeah.
Right? Like our thing here is like you don't have to be a superstar in gaming to be on this podcast. We're not even superstars in gaming.
Nope.
Right? What we want to do is foster community.
Mm-hmm.
We want to make ourselves that active force in creating change rather than reacting.
Yes.
And I think that's a really good segue into another question we got from a future guest.
Oh.
Yeah, a future guest who I met in Buffalo at Queen City Conquest.
Ah, City Conquest.
I don't know if they want me to put their name, like say their real name, but their Twitter handle is These Dead Pens, and they are an amazing artist. And they run a D&D club at their high school.
Ooh,
in
cool.
the States, and it's really awesome. They said, question for all of you. When was the first time in gaming when you felt totally represented? And what's your favorite character in gaming media at the moment?
Oh.
Yeah. So do you have an answer for this? I didn't tell you that this question was coming.
Yeah, you sprung it on me.
I sprung it on you because I wanted to hear what you thought right off the bat.
Oh, what was the first time that I felt totally represented?
Yeah.
That's a...
In gaming, specifically.
In gaming.
Mm-hmm. I have an answer.
Yeah, why don't you answer first and let me think.
Okay, so my answer is actually not in tabletop. I've never felt represented in tabletop.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, like I felt represented in the tabletop community, but never in a game.
Interesting.
Like, you know, like Oriental Adventures doesn't represent who I am.
Yeah.
Right? Either edition of them.
Mm-hmm.
Like any of those like Japanese games mm-hmm. created by white people, that's not who I am because I'm not Japanese.
Yeah, that's true.
Like I have a master's in Japanese archaeology, but that's still not me.
Yeah.
Right. I there's nothing out there in tabletop role-playing games that really captures me.
Okay. So what
that really speaks to me. So the game that, you know, where I felt fully represented in is called Sleeping Dogs.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So, and I lent it to a friend of mine and I never got it back. But that's okay, Adrian.
Oh, jeez.
Nah, it's all good.
Adrian, last name withheld.
Nah. Adrian's good. Like, he, behind the scenes, he makes sure we're all safe at Breakout Con this year.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
So that copy is worth it.
Yeah, totally. But for those of you who don't know, like, Sleeping Dogs is a video game. It came out in 2012. It was published by Square Enix. And developed by, like, United Front Games.
Mm.
And it's about, it takes place in Hong Kong, and it's about a cop who goes undercover with like the triads, the Chinese mafia. And it was a sick game because like I like those open world crime games. I like Grand Theft Auto. I love Red Dead Redemption. I'm excited for Red Dead Redemption 2.
Mm-hmm. You and everyone else.
Me and everyone else. And Sleeping Dogs was the first game where you see these really cool Asian characters, right? Like the main character is voiced by I think it's Will Yun Lee, it's Will Yun Lee, and his name is Wei Shen in the story. And he's this undercover cop. He's like really good looking. He's rugged, but he's not just like a combat character. He's not just a martial artist. He's a sensitive character. He's thoughtful.
Yeah.
Right? He's competent.
Yeah.
And so I was like, that's the game that I like.
Mm-hmm.
I like the fact that this is a game about Asians. I really like that. And also, like, I have a huge crush on Will Yun Lee.
Okay, that's fair.
Do you know who he is?
Nah, I don't know who he is.
He was in The Wolverine. He plays the archer guy.
Oh, okay.
He's also in, what's it called? Altered Carbon.
Oh, okay.
He plays the...
I didn't watch it.
It sucks.
Yeah, that's why I didn't watch it.
That show sucks. He plays, like, Takashi Kovacs when he's, like, Asian, when he's actually good.
I don't know. You're saying words.
So, like, the main character in Altered Carbon...
Yeah, I know he jumps, like, between bodies.
Jumps between bodies, but his original bodies are Asian.
Oh, okay.
And Will Yun Lee plays him when he's Asian,
white.
And William Lee is like this amazing martial artist. His Instagram is really awesome because he just posts videos of him like practicing Taekwondo.
Wow.
Yeah, the guy's legit.
Okay.
Guy's
cool.
Legit.
Yeah.
He was also in Hawaii 5-0. I don't know if you ever watched that.
No.
Oh, so for the listeners, if you ever watched Hawaii 5-0, before all that controversy about pay, because like,
oh yeah,
like that sucked.
Yeah.
And I get why that left. And Daniel Dae Kim, like Grace Park, like ballers.
Yeah.
But there was this recurring criminal named Sang-min, and he played. He's the guy with the mullet, and he's like a human trafficker.
Okay.
I mean, the character is not objectively a good person, but he's a good actor.
Yeah, shout out.
So when I felt represented in gaming, it was in Sleeping Dogs.
Okay.
And my favorite character in gaming media at the moment.
Uh huh.
Ah, man. Right now, like, I really like the characters in Overwatch.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of Asian characters there, but I all think they're caricatures. But every character in Overwatch is kind of a character.
Yeah.
Hanzo and Genji. Like, Hanzo's like, oh, I'm the ninja archer, and Genji's is the cyber ninja.
Yeah.
And Mei is like, oh, I'm Asian, but I'm smart. I'm the scientist.
Yeah.
Right? And then there's Symmetra is South Asian.
Yeah.
She's cool. But I think right now I'm playing a lot of that game, Rainbow Six Siege.
Mm-hmm.
And that game is really cool because there are Asian characters.
Yeah.
And they're skilled and they're competent military operators. So right now I'm playing a lot with this character called Echo, and he's Japanese.
Ooh, nice.
And he's got this little drone that flies around and it could like stick onto ceilings and turn invisible.
Yeah.
And when people go near it, you can like stun them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, I really like that. So right now in games media, I like Echo from Rainbow Six because he's the character that I want to play as. Like, I log on to the game pretty much every day, my friend Angus, and we play, and I'm always trying to get good with Echo. So,
okay.
So how about you? When did you feel, like, represented, like, totally represented in a game?
You know, it's really funny because I was thinking back, and it's actually in a game of Monster of the Week.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so in...
So was it the story or...
It was the character that I made.
Okay.
But it was the way that everyone interacted with it as well. Where it was, this was a game on the Gauntlet. Shout out to the Gauntlet.
Yeah, shout out to the Gauntlet.
Which is like an online gaming community. In that game, I made a Korean-American character because it was set in America. I think it was like in California or something.
Right.
And I basically, the character was basically kind of like the way that people around me act. But she just happens to have like, oh, I think she was a vampire. Anyway, it was just, there was something about the way that she was just like living her everyday life. She likes partying, but she also has to solve crimes. And then it's just like, and sometimes she has like uncontrollable urges for blood, you know, like the,
hey, like Asian characters.
Yeah, like the usual Asian experience.
I just want that blood.
You know, no biggie. But it, the way that I acted for her was basically the way, I think it was like, an expanded version of one aspect of the way I act, just like very sassy and very like,
tell me about it,
like I am playing with this kind of thing. And it's just, I felt really comfortable in her skin. And then sometimes, like, because a lot of our the mysteries, the weekly mysteries would take us into, like, basically the American Midwest.
Yeah.
And which is, like, all white. Well, I would always ask. I would be like, oh, like, is it all white? And then the person running it would be like, yes, it's the American Midwest. Well, actually, that's not true. There are a couple of
I'm sure white. there are Asians there.
No, there were, like, I think it was, like, there were white people and there were black people. But, like, you know, like, it makes sense.
American Midwest. So your character is kind of like a better version of Kevin Tran from Supernatural.
Kind of. But, like, the best thing is, like, there was one part where I specifically was like, there was, like, another Asian character. And then my character was like, hey, we need to sneak into this, it was like a creepy carnival that has, you know, it was a supernatural mystery. We need to sneak in here. Let's pretend to be twins. That character was Japanese, and my character was just like, honestly, none of these people are going to be able to tell us apart. We can just pretend to be twins.
Right.
And we did. And it was just so funny because it's like it really flipped that on its head. And I just like enjoy that so much.
Because you took ownership of that like, kind of negative thing.
Yeah. And the GM was like, what? And I was like, yup.
Yup.
And then we succeeded. So I think that was the first time. And also I think playing Hearts of Ulin, which is a game that's being developed by LOL right now. LOL from the Gauntlet.
Yeah.
Oh, that game is so good.
I want to play it.
I will run it for you. It's like it's based on like Wuxia stories, yeah. Wuxia tropes. And it.
I want to be Wong Fei Hung.
Yeah, you can. There's a trope that fits that.
Jet Li as him? Legendary performance.
Yeah, actually, Jet Li is boss. But it's...
I hope his health is good.
Well...
I hope so.
Yeah. But so that game, I really enjoy that as well, is because it really gets like a lot of the values that are in a lot of these stories where there's a lot of the things that it's like you just have to respect like older people or like your sense of obligation is very like communal. And it's just you don't get that in like a Western game because like a lot of Western games, even if it's set in the past, were like
still about you.
Where values were really different then. But because we're coming from like a present day point of view, it's always like it's very liberalism or it's like it's very like self-focused. So it's always like me, what I care about is more important than anyone else, my self-development, my needs. Mm-hmm. Whereas like that game is very like
it should be like the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one.
Yeah, it's like I want to do this, but also like I like my bonds to these organizations, to my family or whatever really matter in a way that I feel even now, like just as like an Asian person. like it's just like these bonds, they're deeper. Like you might not necessarily like them, but they matter. And that really showed up in that game. And I was like, oh, I can vibe with this so well.
Yeah.
Like this, it's so true. I can't just like throw away like the needs of my family because that's my life.
No, that's your life. And if people don't get that, well, they're at odds with your character.
Yeah. And then like this game just like really allowed for me to do that. So that's where I felt really represented as well. I don't really have like a character.
So no favorite character?
No, there's not enough.
There's not enough. Yeah.
So like one day.
Yeah. In gaming, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
I guess if it's hard to... Yeah, there's not too many.
No, there's not
that
an Asian
like
one.
Martial artists.
Yeah, like if
I picked one who could fight, but I think he's a little bit deeper than that.
Yeah, I mean, if I wanted to pick a character that is like my favorite character, it would be FemShep.
FemShep.
Yeah, from Mass Effect. But
Mass Effect 2 is the best one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, but she's not Asian.
She can be though.
Yeah, she
sort of.
No.
Everybody just makes, like, gets the red hair.
It's true. I also got red hair.
Yeah, that's what I did, too. That's what I did, too. I'm still a little mad at Mass Effect 3, but you know, thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the wounds go deep.
The wounds go deep. Like, I'm still, like, cut real hard. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, we're talking about all of these, like, amazing things in RPG and all these times when we think, RPGs really kind of helped us navigate our identities and helped us kind of connect with our community. And I mean, what I want to talk about before we get into our interview with Kyril is, you know, how RPGs kind of help me survive, like economically.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so for those of you who don't know or haven't seen any of my work on social media, I do a lot of work in education in RPGs. At the moment, I run private RPGs for families across the GTA, the Greater Toronto Area, and I work at a private school, as well as, in talks, fingers crossed, one other private school.
Ooh.
Running D&D for them. And then, of course, I use RPGs at the Royal Ontario Museum to teach kids history, science, and social skills. And if you look online, you'll see that people, there are all these people, all these educators like me who are kind of popping up, mostly in the United States, who are using RPGs for good. And that's kind of why we wanted to, you know, call this episode Learning Through Play. So so I think earlier this year, the Lake Washington Girls Middle School, and they had a teacher there named Ethan Schoonover. I definitely pronounced that wrong. But he kind of started this after school club, and then it became like a pilot D&D camp. And my friend Kat Kruger, who I would love to have on this podcast of D20 Dames, would kind of helped out with that. And we saw that get covered by Geek and Sundry. So we have like major exposure for the educational use of D&D to empower these girls at this school. Then there's a teacher named Cade Wells in Texas at a school called Davis Ninth Grade School. It is kind of near Houston, who basically found that all of the students who were in this D&D club were doing way better on their grades and aptitude tests. And we'll put all the links to these articles on the One Shot Podcast website. But what we see here is this overwhelming positive power of D&D in the classroom.
Yeah.
And I've been involved in D&D and education since 2005. And I've kind of, I was exposed to D&D initially in the classroom. And just like Kyrul, he uses D&D and RPGs and RPG elements to better the lives of people. And I mean, like, I know you've got tons of questions about, you know, why D&D is awesome for education and your own experiences learning.
Yeah. And even just like speaking of games that have been used for education, there's New World Magiscola as well, which is it's a LARP.
Okay.
It's a North American LARP.
We gotta go to a LARP.
Yeah. We have to go to New World Magiscola. I've been nonstop bugging everyone around me.
So tell me about it. I don't know anything about the LARP world.
My gosh. Well, okay, so
see, this is where education.
Yeah.
tell me about it. I don't know anything about it.
Oh, don't worry.
I just want to buy one of those LARP swords.
Yes.
I want one so bad. I want to hang it above the bed. Sarah will kill me if I do, but I want it above the bed.
Hey, I mean, there's that thing. Well, there's in one of the Taiwanese like First Nations tribes, like one of their traditions is to hang a sword above the bed so you can cut away evil spirits. So you won't have nightmares. But anyway, so tell her that.
But then she'll be like, Daniel, I know you're not Taiwanese. And this store's not real.
Try again. So New World Magiscola is a North American LARP inspired by Harry Potter. But they've developed their own houses. And oh my gosh, like if you read the histories, like they specifically wanted to take like North American heritage and like or things that are like important to North America and like North American history, and they incorporated it into the four houses. So it's very inclusive and
it's
like
a way better Hogwarts because I got mad problems.
Oh my
with
gosh,
Harry Potter. Harry Potter does not age well.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't,
and it especially doesn't age well with with J.K. Rowling.
No, she's ruining Harry Potter with her Twitter.
Yeah, pretty much. Everyone else is trying to salvage it except for her. But anyway, so they were even starting, they really wanted it to be super inclusive and to like foster a kind of very healthy atmosphere. And they just came out this year with what is called Magiscola Prep. This is specifically for kids ages 11 to 17.
Okay.
So rising 6th to 12th grades. And it's...
we could do that.
No, we cannot.
No, we're not allowed.
I don't think I can pass for being 17. Actually, I probably can't.
I can totally. So some people be a little racist and think that I got carded at an HMV trying to buy a Call of Duty game.
Nice.
When HIV was still around.
I don't get carded no more.
I still get carded.
Like when I buy alcohol, no one cards me.
Why do you think I grow this disgusting mustache and be like, I'm older?
Yeah, honestly, I was going to ask. No. No. Yeah. So, I mean, this is like they also have like just normal New World Magiscola runs that is for right. adults. And this year they just came out with this prep one. And this is like straight up a summer camp.
Where does this take place? Where do they host this?
It's in Swarthmore College, which is near Philadelphia in Penn State. But their New World Magiscola itself, it happens like in the summer. And I think it's like somewhere else.
Damn.
They're all in different locations, but they're all in the States.
Okay.
Yeah, so we can totally do it. We should do it next year.
Well, what I think we should do is go to a LARP and like I'll bring my camera gear and we'll do like a video.
Oh my gosh.
Right?
Oh my gosh.
We should like just get down with all of this different multimedia of us interacting with the gaming industry.
We need to go because...
Like I do videography.
I would 100% do this because I've been looking for an excuse to go play this anyway. It's like not cheap. So anyway... This game, this LARP, this summer camp, they like, I was like looking through their, so it's funny because it says like they learn a variety of skills in a magical context. So there's like rune lore, magical creatures, healing,
oh my God.
Alchemy and more. But it like, it develops, like some of it is like just like math, straight up math. And then some of it is like, for example, like, I think it's like the alchemy part of it is like, they're actually learning about local plants and like right. the uses of local plants for like medicinal purposes or whatever. So like they're learning, and also there's just a lot of communication, collaboration, problem solving, critical thinking, and empathy skills going on, because they also like they come up with like situations where it's like, oh, this is like they have like it's I was reading into it and there's like, oh, there's like a werewolf problem, and like in this world, like werewolves have always been hotly debated, like what should we do with them, like are they people or are they not, and like how should we treat them, should we all put them in one place? And then this is like the kind of discussion that would come up in class,
yeah,
which translates not completely, but it's very interesting in helping like
people navigate identity,
yeah, and helping kids learn about like what is human rights,
yeah,
and like, you know, like how fine the line is between treating people as human and treating people as not. So
that's powerful. Okay, so we gotta we already planned on, so after SkyCon, we went to a mall where all the shops open, mm-hmm. and we just talked about like episodes that we want to do.
Yeah.
And we talked about doing a LARP episode.
Yeah.
So let's make this happen.
Oh, it's going to happen.
And I got to find myself, if you're a listener and you know anything about like LARP weaponry, like,
oh my gosh.
Get in touch with me.
Wait, you're still talking about that sword?
So I'm still thinking about this.
Well, you can't hang it over your bed. We just talked about this.
I'll put it under the pillow.
That's even worse.
but you know, we're talking about like, whoa, I was intense. No worries. No, but we're talking about how like, you know, role-playing games and role-playing in general, because mm-hmm. this can include LARPs and like TTRPGs, but how these analog games and these fictional narratives and this collaborative storytelling empowers people. It empowers people to learn. And it empowers people to better themselves through gamified learning. It's awesome. Like you said, like you're exploring your own sense of morality, and you provide an alternative way of discovering, contextualizing, and solving problems.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be, you know, navigating identity, talking about human rights.
Yeah.
Like Kyrol talked about in the interview portion of this episode, like talking about the environment,
yeah,
right, the tsunami in Japan,
yeah,
or talking about or navigating the politics of religion in historic Malaysia,
mm-hmm.
right, and these are all things you can easily read in a book, but you retain these things when you play them in a game.
Yeah, and when you're a character reacting to that reality as it's like pressing, it's like impacting you, or like, I don't know, the NPCs that you care about or you interact with, that feels so much more different because you're immersed in it versus you're just like reading it.
You are an active agent in your education.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like, that's what I do. So like, I am pretty sure I am the only one in the world who uses, if there are other people out there who are listening to this online or know somebody, connect me to them. But I'm pretty sure I'm the only one in the world who uses D&D on a regular basis to do long-term education in a museum context.
Yeah,
and that's very specific.
That is very specific.
It's very specific. But what I do is I help kids, you know, learn about problem solving that, and then take those skills outside to the lived realities of the world beyond the museum.
Mm-hmm.
I contextualize all the history in the museum. So when you go to a museum, like you go to the Royal Ontario Museum and you see all these incredible, amazing artifacts. You look at them, you're like, oh, that's neat, and you move on.
Yeah.
And then you forget. Right? But if you're playing D&D, we have like a model of an Egyptian tomb.
Mm-hmm.
What if you're playing D&D inside that tomb?
Right.
Because we do that.
Right.
Right. But we're not playing D&D. Maybe we're playing Call of Cthulhu.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe we're playing...
Oh, that's sick.
Yeah. And that's what we do.
Yeah.
Right. Or maybe we're going to play D&D, but next to the dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk about scale. And we're going to sit next to the... sit underneath the T-Rex and imagine a huge reptilian beast standing over us.
Right.
Right. Or maybe we're playing End of the World Zombie Apocalypse by Fantasy Flight Games. And we did that. And we did it with 30 students. So my staff and I, we did it with 30 students. And Zombie Apocalypse happens during our D&D camp in the summer. We got to board up the museum. We got to find ourselves some weaponry. And we went around the museum with my staff, and the kids took inventory of weapons that they thought would be functional, right?
Wow.
Yeah, they looked at the architecture of the building. Right? It was really cool. But also, I have the luxury of being able to do things like archery.
Right.
So one of the things that I do in the summers is collaborating with one of my mentors at the museum, Dr. Robert Mason, is I give all of my students the opportunity to experience that D&D world just a little bit. And we go and we shoot historical bows and arrows.
Yeah, it's pretty sick.
So we string up English longbows, like Mongolian and Roman bows. And we go and we shoot them. We feel how hard it is to draw back the bow. We see how hard it is to actually aim a shot.
Mm-hmm.
So that when they go into D&D and they're trying to do these things with their bows, they're actually, their narrative is now informed by their actual lived experience with a real bow and arrow.
Yeah.
But also if we're talking about, we're talking about historical battles. We're talking about siege tactics. We're talking about the different parts of the sword and we're handling swords. These are all things that enrich their ability to tell stories.
Yeah. It's like art mimics life, but then that also in turn enriches their knowledge.
Yeah, and that's just the history and world building. Like, there are so many games that specifically teach history. Like, Ross Rifles. That teaches you the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first games that I actually brought in that wasn't a fantasy RPG was Night Witches.
Right,
by Jason Morningstar. Because I wanted to talk about World War II. But I wanted to further contextualize the war and actually tell stories that are seldom told about the war with my students. So I brought out a copy of Night Witches. I talked about the war. I talked about, the wars on both fronts for Germany. I talked about Stalin's war with Germany.
Right.
And then we all played Night Witches to learn that this war was not fought just by men.
Right.
And we talked about the challenges faced by these Soviet airwomen in the Night Witches. And it was really awesome.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about science. We have, because the ROM is a natural and cultural history museum, so we talk about science. We'll go and we'll talk about, food chains. We'll talk about food webs. We'll talk about, different ecosystems. We'll talk about, native and invasive species. And then we'll go and we'll play a game like The Warren.
Oh, nice.
And that game is real scary.
Yeah, that game is real scary. A horror game.
It's straight up a horror game. So we played The Warren. And I actually had a kid who was not very engaged with D&D initially.
Mm.
And when we played The Warren, he was instantly into it because he had a pet rabbit.
Oh.
And so he took his understanding of his pet rabbit and he helped the other kids role play as rabbits in the game.
Oh, nice.
He's like, a rabbit wouldn't behave like that because this is how a rabbit moves.
Right.
And now everybody knows about rabbits. And then we're starting to think, okay, if the rabbits are trying to escape the museum, because that was our game,
mm-hmm.
we had this story where this woman came into our office with a basket full of bunnies
mm-hmm.
and tried to pitch like a live show. And we're like, why do you have a basket full of bunnies? You just randomly showed up. But that was the plot hook. And the campers, the kids, the students played these rabbits that escaped.
Right.
And they were trying to escape the ROM. And one of the things that I had them do was research what were the dangers outside of the museum.
Right.
What local animals could pose a threat to them? Peregrine falcons, red-tailed hawks, humans. What is the ecosystem like? Would a rabbit be able to survive? Where would a rabbit have to go? And so then we're starting to think about local biodiversity.
Yeah.
In an RPG. And that is something special. And that's something you can do in your home with your family.
Yeah.
Like that's something that, you know, you could take anywhere. You're not going to get that in a video game. You're not going to be able to sit and do research and then change the entire outcome of your game, change how the game's being played.
Yeah.
Right? That's special. And that's why RPGs will never die.
Yeah.
Right? But also, like, if you think about it, like, despite everything, like Kyrol said in his interview, despite being fictional, you know, invented realms are inherently derivative.
Right.
They're inherently derivative. So just because they're fictional, just because like Tolkien's Middle Earth is fictional, there are elements of it that are very much drawn from history. And you can see that. And so one of the things that I've been doing for the past, oh my God, it's been a really long time. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden I feel kind of old.
How many
Although
years?
Although not old. It's been 7 years.
Okay.
It's a D&D campaign that's lasted 7 years.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. It lasted several generations of kids too.
Mm-hmm.
So my students come from the ages of 10 to 14, so roughly 5 years for them. Some of them like to stretch it out a little longer because they got late birthdays.
Right.
But we created our own world.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't use the Forgotten Realms in our D&D campaigns. And these are all of our fantasy campaigns. So Dungeon World, Pathfinder, D&D 5e.
Oh, wow.
All of our games take place in a shared world.
Wow, that's very cool.
Yeah, because, I mean, they only differ mechanically.
Yeah,
but the stories take place in the same realm.
Right.
Right. And with the kids, we've actually created this entire world. We've created a world that's been inspired by all of our experiences in the museum.
Mm-hmm.
Like all of the lessons that I've ever taught, all of the artifacts. We have an entire part of the world where there are these humans who are basically exiles from their main temperate climate. They live in this desert and they've developed this symbiotic relationship with these elephants. Kind of like the Oliphants in Tolkien.
Right.
But the kids really wanted to like write about these elephant riding people. And so I said, okay. So I went to the curatorial center at the museum and I said, okay, I have all these kids and they want to know about elephants in war. Do we have any artifacts? And we brought out like elephant hide shields.
Wow.
And so all our entire world is inspired by the materiality of the museum.
Right.
And kids retain that because they know. I have a kid who's constantly, he played a dragonborn and there's this whole realm called the Autumn Realm where the dragonborns kind of live.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a campaign there and he really contributed to it. And he now tells all of the other kids about it so that this knowledge of the world is spread amongst different cohorts. And so they all know about the world. So when they're role playing, it's less driven by the GM and more driven by them.
Right.
They're like, okay, well, we know that the Dragonborns live here and they might have answers. My character's a Dragonborn, so I might be able to talk to them about this. So let's find passage there and I'll take the lead when conversing with them. Other people might find me scary, but these people don't because they're with me.
Right.
And I mean, that's what makes D&D really special to me.
Right.
And of course, there's like math and science, like I said, with the Warren.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not good at math, despite the stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
I'm terrible at math.
Neither am I.
I'm so awful at it, but I'm really good at D&D math. Like, I'm good at, like, quick thinking. Like, I throw out the dice and be like, count it up.
Right.
Or, like, I can look through spreadsheets really quickly because a character sheet is just a spreadsheet.
Right.
That doesn't do the math for you and you have to do it all.
Yeah.
Right.
So you learn that skill.
Yeah, you learn that skill. Like RPGs are so important and so empowering.
Yeah.
No matter who uses it. It's not just for children. It's for adults.
Mm-hmm.
Like
I'm not a child.
We learned about Malaysia today in the context of talking about RPGs.
Yeah, straight up.
Like I didn't know anything about Malaysia. Now I want to know everything about it.
Yeah, it sounds very interesting.
Yeah. Like have you had a recent experience? But before we get on to this amazing conversation with Kyrol. Have you ever had, what would you say is the most educational RPG to you? And I know this is a really loaded question.
Yeah.
But have you played an RPG where you felt like your mind was blown, or you took something new out of it? Not in the storytelling experience, but in the content of the game.
Yeah, actually, so this is interesting too, because this also shows the flexibility of just of these games, of RPGs in general. But yeah, this was a game of Monster Hearts, which is a game.
You love that game. This is the second time you brought that up.
Listen, yeah, that was like first games I ever played. It's a real mean game, kind of, because you have to play like mean high schoolers. And the system,
I'm not good at that.
The system rewards that. But you could also be nice. I've encountered those characters as well. Anyway, this game, it was really educational because it was set in a historic setting, and the GM herself like put a lot of research into it.
What was the historical setting?
So it was actually a series of settings. One of them is oh no, she's gonna kill me. the GM is Kat Roman, and she I don't think she listens, but she's also like,
how dare she?
She's a game creator. She wrote anyway, so she like is really good at doing historical games, very historically specific ones. This one is set in basically, it's like 1690. It's during the time of the Salem Witch Trials.
Oh, okay, cool.
And it was like, it was set in Kingsport, so it's like got that Cthulhu vibe.
Yep.
But it's just, she gave us a primer of the time, and then like of like, you know, it's kind of like the way people dressed, and then like how like people's social lives were, and then like what the geography was like, just like all these different things, and also like historically like what just happened, and then how people usually greeted each other, all these things like in just like a short, I think it was a 2 or 3 page document. And I feel like I learned so much from that and from playing that game. And I was like really mind blown, actually, by the amount of research she put into it. And then she's running another one right now. It's set in the it's like the late 50s, but basically, no, it's set in the mid 60s, but it still has a kind of like 50s vibe.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's before the go-go boots were like really a thing. And that one, she also like had a huge primer. This was like during the Nixon administration, and just right, like all of that. I was like, I am learning so much from this. I did not know anything about these parts of American history.
Yeah.
And that was just like blew my mind. And it was like from a game of Monster Hearts where I was like prepared to be a mean teen.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And I think, I mean, it's always, as a GM, it's so rewarding when your players learn.
Yeah.
And like, and I hope if you're a player and your GM puts a lot of work into your games, like make sure you show them some love.
Yeah, actually read those documents.
Yeah, actually read those documents. I have a friend, speaking of like American history.
Yeah.
I have a friend and she's doing her PhD in like literary depictions of witchcraft.
Ooh.
Yeah, so I actually had her come in, because, you know, I'm really big on collaboration. Yeah. I like learning from people, and I like to make sure that my students learn from the best.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought her, I invited her in to come talk to my class about magic. Like, what was magic really? What is magic? What are the different types of magic? And, well, let's like really talk about historically what witches were like, and how, you know, oftentimes these, I would say almost always, these witch trials were really attempts to take away the agency of women.
Yeah.
And so we talked about witchcraft. And they took this and they were like, oh my God, okay, I have to really think about how I want to describe my magic user.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Am I more in tune with nature?
Yeah.
It's really cool. Actually, tomorrow, I'm doing two lectures. I'm doing a morning lecture. We're talking about legendary blades. And we're talking about why magic swords appear in history.
Oh, that's super cool.
And then we're talking like specifically, we'll talk a little bit about Excalibur, but I really want to talk about things that they might not know about. And we're going to talk about the Muramasa blades in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And in the afternoon, we're talking about the Franklin Expedition.
Ooh.
Yeah. The Erebus and the Terror, and how these ships disappeared in the Arctic, and how collaboration with, you know, indigenous knowledge helped recover these ships.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Right? But these are all tropes in fantasy.
Yeah.
Like traveling into uncharted lands.
Yeah.
Legendary blades, maybe cursed blades that give you bloodlust, like the Muramasa blades are believed to do.
Yeah. Right?
But all of these historical things, you know, are drawn upon by game designers.
Yeah.
Because all the games that we play and all these stories that we tell are derivative of something that happened in history, or all the art that we see is derivative of things that actually existed.
Yeah. So because the nature of creation or like creativity or art is that art mimics life.
Yeah.
But these things, these games are by nature interacted with by people. Like people take these systems and take these settings and they infuse whatever knowledge they have into it, and then people are interacting with them. This means that we are always learning when we're playing these games.
Yeah, and I think that's the perfect segue into our interview with the amazing Kyril Hisham.
Do, 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 do.
One of the things that I wanted to talk about with you was your work using RPGs to teach English, which I think is unique. I've never met anybody who does that.
Really? I would have thought like someone in the North America would have tried it with, you know.
Yeah, it's a brilliant idea.
Yeah, it really is, but I've never met anybody who's doing that. And let alone like another Asian person who's doing that in Asia. Right?
Yeah, right.
And we were saying earlier that, like, at least to me, you kind of, when I think of Southeast Asia and I think of, you know, the Southeast Asian like creator sort of scene, I think of you, I think of, you know, hishgraphics.com, and I think of like Munkau, who has the Thousand Thousand Islands zine, which I desperately want a copy of it. It's beautiful. I don't know if you've ever seen this. They're beautiful fire things.
They were at this book fair a couple of weeks back, but I couldn't, you know, I was not able to head down there to visit them and stuff.
Yeah, I want a copy so bad. I'm probably just going to have to go and order one. We want to know more about how you got into using RPGs, you know, for good, or RPGs to teach people languages. Because, I mean, one of the things, and I mean, did you end up finishing the first episode of Asians Represent?
Yeah, I did.
And so one of the things we wanted to say was like, you know, the first episode was very much a call to action for creators and consumers.
Yep.
And this episode is very much kind of like the opposite of that. This is like one of the first episodes where we celebrate a creator in the community who's doing something really awesome. And that doesn't have to mean publishing books or, you know, having major publishing deals or anything like that. It's about like making a difference for your community and the wider gaming community, and of course representing. And you're doing that. You're using RPGs to teach people languages. And I think that's one of the most innovative ways to A, like represent Asians in the gaming community, but also like help people locally.
Yep.
And I want to know how you got into that. Like, Agatha has never talked to you before and hasn't really heard about you, but you and I have kind of been connected for, I got to say like months, maybe a year.
Yeah, maybe a year. I think it's been a year.
Yeah, this is the first time that we've actually got to talk. So I want Agatha to learn all about you, and I want our audience to know, you know, exactly what you're doing. So what are you doing with RPGs?
What I do is I'm an English teacher at our university, which is University Malaysia Perlis. It's a relatively small university, which is located north of the country. It's about maybe 400 kilometers away from Kuala Lumpur. So I moved here to be a translator at first. So I was translating documents from Bahasa Malaysia to English. Then after about a year and a half, they said, "Hey, why don't you try teaching?" So I thought, "I've never tried teaching before." So I gave it a shot. And to my surprise, I loved it. I know it's like I never thought about teaching before, but the things that I went through in my life in the last 2 decades or so, it allowed me to connect more with the students.
So, you said the things that you went through allowed you to connect more with the students? Said, what do you mean?
Like, there's a business school. So our language center will have to teach the students from the business school and from the engineering school. And there's one, they call it the ICOM, which is they do new media and stuff. And lo and behold, I've been on the internet since nonstop since 2001. So I know about how forums were back then, and how, you know, I was there for the rise of social media, and I can relate to the students that way. You know, I can tell them, you know, about this and memes, local memes, national memes, and they respond well to that.
Right.
Yeah.
And how did that jump from memes to RPGs?
So going back, you know, I first started playing RPGs in 1989.
Oh.
Nice.
So, wow.
Yeah. I started with Star Wars RPG because I was a really big Star Wars fan. Well, I am a really big Star Wars fan. So I noticed that everyone who I played with, and we weren't from any big city in Malaysia, you know, me and my friends, we were in a small town, a small sleepy town back then, and English, you know, not a lot of people spoke English, but after 20 years, I've noticed that everyone who played the Star Wars RPG, AD&D back then, Robotech, I know couple of guys played the Robotech RPG. All of us, our English advanced faster, and it stuck with us until in our 40s. So that in itself, to me, is, you know, at very least anecdotal evidence that RPGs can be used for language learning.
Right, of course, because I mean, you're making it, you know, real. You're making it applicable to what you're doing in everyday life.
And it's like democratization of language learning. You know, you don't tell them what to learn, but you put them in a situation where it's exciting and it speaks to them. For instance, I do have to check out each class to see what they like. You know, ask them what genre they like, and then if let's say they like horror, and most of them like horror, it's a Southeast Asian thing, or but when I ask them what do you like most, you know, action adventure, no, horror, okay, sure.
What horror RPG do you use then?
I use at the moment I use Mini 6, which is an offshoot of the Open D6
yeah system. I know that,
yeah. And it's fast, and I can respond to the students faster than, say, you know, if I need to check out tables and stuff, so I can do it on the fly.
Yeah, because I guess for you, it's really all about the social interaction. It's about the narrative rather than actually the mechanical crunch of it.
Yeah, but you know, I try to. Get them to understand the crunch of it, you know, at least, at the very least, so that they know that when they get this and there's certain things that happen to them, you know, you have, if you fail at this, this will happen. If you succeed at this, this will happen. This is what you have to do to succeed, and this is what you have to do to fail. And I hope that's the only thing that I need to tell them. And after that, all they have to do is just speak to class.
So, do you usually tie these games to specific like lesson plans, or is this just? Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. The first game that I planned, did not, because I didn't know what I was doing. But there was one class where I tried to run these games in classes where there's less students than normal. Mm. Usually I get about 30, 35 students, but if I have a class with 20 students or less, I'll usually use that class. So it's easier to manage the whole thing. So
yeah.
One of these classes, I looked at the lesson plan and we had to do, we had to talk about the theme was natural disasters. And one of the things during that week and the next week was that we have to learn about and write descriptive essays. Mm. So what I did was I created three gems of mini-six characters, and they were all international agents. And I sent them all to Fukushima.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, for the tsunami and the nuclear station.
Tsunami. So they had to, and they had to respond to the things that happened, and you know, also there were some supernatural things that were happening, like undead ninjas were attacking them. Which I'm sure
but, that we know of.
That we know of. You know. So they saved the villagers from being killed by the cult of the undead ninjas. However, they were right by the sea, and I actually projected a map of the area. So we had the names of villages and rivers and the coastline and the towns and the geographical features of the area. So they can actually say, you know, let's drive to Iwata. Yeah, what are you going to drive in? You know, you don't have a car. And they say, oh, I'm going to go and steal this car from here. And
so, of course.
Yeah, so they roll the dice and blah, blah, blah. So in the end, they saved that. And then I asked them to roll a perception check. And I told them that there was this loud rumbling noise that was coming from the sea. And they looked out. And all along the horizon, there was no horizon. It was just a sea, and it just faded into gray and then into the sky, and the gray band was increasing in size as if it was rapidly closing in on them, you know. It's a tsunami, and I told them, okay, what do you want to do in a tsunami? So the students, being, you know, 20-year-olds, 19-year-olds who have not really experienced tsunami before, so they said that,
right,
okay, I'm gonna run, let's jog to the nearest village,
jog away from this tsunami.
Right? You can see that, you know, and I tell them, you can see the thing coming, right? Yes, I'm gonna jog to the nearest village, and we're going to warn everyone there. And you know, after about 50 meters, the tsunami hit. And I said, okay, you have to roll your swimming skill, and anyone gets over 20 gets a chance at surviving. You know, you get washed on some debris or a fishing boat goes by and you can manage to grab on or something like that. None of them did.
So oh my god.
Total party kill.
Oh my god, how do they feel about that?
Seems pretty realistic.
I don't know. They didn't sound disappointed. They were actually excited with it. But
nice.
Next time we played, they created new characters, and we made it a part of the same campaign, where they were part of the same international espionage agent group, and the theme was. Pollution, and so I sent them to the Amazon jungle to investigate a factory that was polluting the Amazon River. And,
So you say that it's usually with like 20, when the class is around 20 students, right? That
you would. I've already made some decisions on how I would want them to engage in class. For example, if there's like, let's say if I have 8 pre-gens, if I have 24 students, I would get 3 students to handle one character.
And
somebody will speak, most probably the guy who speaks the best. Somebody else will be taking notes, and somebody else will be writing a report.
Oh,
and
wow.
What I did was I gave them a link to a Google form to every group of students. You know, at that point, I think there was like 3 or 4 students per character for the first one, the tsunami game. Mm-hmm. And they came up, they produced a descriptive essay. You know, one of the questions I asked them was basic stuff. Describe your character. And then, why did you go there? What were the things that you encountered? What happened in the middle? Anything strange happened? And then in the end, what happened? So they wrote based on the questions they asked them. And and they did fine. I mean, one of the students even said that, you know, she played a scientist. So she said that she goes everywhere in a white lab coat, even though she doesn't have to. And she described that she has chocolate bars or some sort of a candy in all her pockets because, you know, she likes to eat candy. And nothing to do with the game, nothing to do with it. It's just things that she had to describe. And I found that to be wow, you know?
Oh, that is so cool.
Yeah, like totally pun intended. They're adding flavor to the game. That's really great. Like the way I, when you described the initial tsunami campaign and you were talking about how they said we're going to jog away from the tsunami, I kind of thought, oh, this is a learning opportunity to find another word related to running that implies a faster, more directed run and not a casual run. So I'm really bad at languages. I don't even speak English that well. And it's my first language. So I tried to take Chinese classes because I was living in China. And so I went to night school with my brother to learn Chinese. And I worked so hard. He didn't even work at all. And I worked so hard and my Chinese sucked. And I feel like if that Chinese class was us like playing RPGs in Chinese, I would know so much more because I would have a reason to use it.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I can totally see this. Yeah. I would like be flipping that dictionary all the time.
Oh, yeah. Except my Chinese would be super specific to fantasy. So you don't just use RPGs in your classroom. Do you do more traditional forms of teaching as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I actually rarely use RPGs in the classroom. I teach like you know everybody else.
Yeah, and the RPGs kind of become that sort of special supplementary class.
If I think the class can handle it, sometimes we get a really introverted class.
And, of course.
Whatever I do, I think they might not enjoy. If I think they will not enjoy it, I will not force them.
Right,
of course. You want the students to engage in something they're passionate about, something that they will actually apply themselves to. Yeah. So in addition to, you know, teaching English and using RPGs, I mean, you're also doing art. You've got these like really awesome like paper miniatures that you put out. Like I'm showing Agatha right now your Lovecraftian RPG paper minis as well, and you do the Star Wars ones as well. Like, how'd you get into that? Was it because of your teaching, or was it because of like playing RPGs with your family? Because I noticed that
when I was in Kuala Lumpur, when I was still doing freelance illustration. So I was a freelance illustrator before I came to work in the university here. So I did thanks to the help of my friend, Gary Esselford, and Stan Brown, they gave me my first break.
Right.
I drew for the game's mechanics. I drew interior artwork for the Future Player's Companion, which is a D20
nice.
Future
yeah.
supplement written by Rodney Thompson and Gary Esselford himself, if I'm not mistaken. And after that, I just, you know, like, went everywhere. Like when I said earlier that I was on the internet and since 2001, I wasn't joking. You know, I was like on it all the time because
uh-huh.
I was doing free Star Wars character artwork requests for the Star Wars RPG community online. And because of that, I had a lot of things on my portfolio. So I, but they were, you know, they were not really good work back then. But I
right.
held my things around and see whether anybody would, you know, can you pay me to for me to draw in your book? And after the Future Player's Companion, I had a really big job. From Wicked North Games to do the SMR Player's Core Rulebook, which is an open D6 fancy book.
Yeah.
Yeah, so from there, everything just snowballed, you know. I did another book with them called Westward, which is a space western steampunk thing.
Nice.
And I also did some work with Heroic Journey Publishing, a couple of Mecha RPG supplements. So I also drew Mecha and Kaiju.
Yeah.
One of the supplements is Mecha Kaiju.
Of course, of course, you got to do Kaiju.
Right.
Yeah, one of the things that I really like about your art, in particular the paper minis, is that you've actually provided people through like your Patreon and through your free stuff, you've provided people with Asian character miniatures. Because that's something that's really hard to find. Because if I think about, you know, if I want to play an Asian character, the only minis that I can think of getting are like
ninjas.
Or even if you get what's called Rising Sun by Cool Mini or Not, that board game, they have tons of minis, but they're all like samurai and ninjas and stuff.
Yeah.
But you've got, so I'm showing Agatha your Enigma Corps minis right now.
That's not mine per se, but it was requested.
Yeah.
But you're
still producing it.
Right,
you're still producing this art. And that's special because now if I want to, you know, play an Asian like officer with sort of military looking garb, I'm looking at a mini that represents me or can represent me. And that's really cool because you're providing materials for people who want to be represented on their tables.
Yeah, instead of only in specific types of characters or archetypes.
Yeah. Like you're doing like the RPG community like a great service. And I've noticed through Instagram that, you know, Southeast Asia has like this booming like D&D community. And I noticed now that you're getting into D&D with your family, right?
Right. Yeah. And I'm using Southeast Asian legends and tropes, you know, instead of the Western Tolkien-esque fantasy model.
Right.
So like what kind of like legends and tropes are you using?
Okay, so basically I'm using the Malacca Empire as a base.
Right.
Do you know about the Malaccan Empire?
No.
Okay, so it's a 15th century empire which is based in the Straits of Malacca, where Malaysia is now. And they were the people that, you know, locally we lionized that that time period.
Okay.
We remember the sultans and then the heroes, the things that they do. There's a lot of mythological elements and supernatural elements to it. Although it interweaves along with Muslim and Islamic background, because that's when Islam first reached our shores.
Right.
Right. So my idea was, also the other thing was, it instead of a homogenous, instead of just a homogenous, you know, like an empire where everybody's the same culture and the same ethnic group. Historically, we had people from all over. So we had we sent ambassadors to China, and China had their own representatives here, and we had people from the Arabian countries, from some as far as Europe. So, and of course, India. And
right.
I plan on having all these different cultures existing in my campaign.
That is so cool.
Can you please publish this so we can play it?
I know.
I'm gonna work towards that. Yeah, but
fine tune it, and then. Oh my god, that just sounds so great.
Yeah, it sounds so rich and so layered, and there's like so many aspects to it that you're, even just the brief description that you gave, it's like all the politics and
all the politics and different religions interacting.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's what we talked about on episode one of Asians Represent. Like, Asian cultures are varied and diverse. And your home game of D&D is exactly what we were like, what we crave.
Yeah.
From like Asian inspired D&D. And it's like, oh my God, we just got to fly to Malaysia.
So the other thing I was doing was visiting the museums here. And recently during Eid, I went home to my parents' place, and we went to visit a museum where it had a lot of melee weapons. An entire level was just
all Malacca weapons.
Not Malacca, but all over, even pre-Malacca, post-Malacca, because there's a lot of empires here, you know, throughout the years, throughout the centuries. There's the Srivijaya and Aceh, and it's they should all be more or less the same, because ethnically we're all the same, but because it's all over a range of many centuries, and then we have colonialism and people come in and, you know, they split it up, and
it's like Portuguese
for us to say, oh, this is Malaysian or this is Indonesian, you know. But in the earlier, you know, like even the south of Thailand was part of the empire.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and then,
that's really awesome.
That's very interesting.
So do you think you'll be bringing this historical approach to your teaching? Or do you think you're going to be strictly focusing on languages?
My job would be just to focus on the language. But based on my interest, I would like to publish something. You know, just get this book out. So at the very least, you can play it, you know.
Oh, I'll play the heck out of that at the museum here.
Yes.
I mean, like, the way you describe your game is very similar to how I play D&D at work. I mean, have you talked to like local museums about doing D&D for like locally outside of your university?
No, that's a good idea. I sent an email to a local library, but I haven't thought about the museums yet.
Yeah, because you would. I mean, is D&D really popular in Malaysia?
It's getting more popular, but I don't think it's reached that level yet.
Oh, fingers crossed.
Yeah, or if you can run any game just within the setting, it just it seems like such a great educational tool.
So
and also though,
but
the
setting itself, I will not put it. I'm not going to put it at a real historical setting because in my game the campaign itself, it starts out like this: a fleet of I don't know, I think about 50 ships because they were really big ships, and we used Chinese junks.
Okay.
Yeah, and because our the old empire also had Chinese junks, we call them Zhongs. And during one of the sails towards China, they traveled through a mist one night. The mist was glowy and, you know, it's weird and everything. And when once they passed through the mist, after 3 days, they looked up and they saw that the stars were not right. And they found themselves in another, in a D&D world, so to speak.
Oh, that's cool.
Right. And it's been 130 years since, so they've created their own enclave there.
Oh.
And then they have all these different people from different ethnic backgrounds and cultures in a city, and you know they have to farm and mine the area so they can survive. But they're still trying to find a way back. So
right.
It's been 130 years. So realistically, it will be almost the 17th century or 18th century by then. So we mm-hmm. will also have firearms, because by that time, even in the 15th century, middle to late 15th century, the government, the kingdom, actually produced firearms. You know, like matchlocks and flintlocks.
Yeah, there are of course.
Of it, you know? There are even local terms for it, which I'm going to use in the game.
So, why don't you want to set it just in the historical, straight up?
People can be fickle. The general audience, so at this point...
Yeah, I think people would take detail.
Yeah, so besides historical details, because it's open and you have religions and there'll be magic, and some people might take offense.
You might find parts of it offensive.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so let's make it. Oh yeah, this is how I'm going to do it. I'm going to frame magic. So in this new land that they're in, which is all islands, as far as they can tell. So it's like an archipelago. And there's magic. So magic is some sort of a nature, you know, they get energy that's given off by nature, some sort of force. But also, some people have innate magic, so that we can have all those different classes, typical D&D classes, we can use them.
Uh-huh.
However, that's really smart.
However, because the core of the people who went and got themselves lost there are not just Muslims, but Muslim scholars as well. They accept this magic as part of nature. And
that's fascinating.
Yeah, but of course there will be groups of people who you know, the typical burn the books, you know, magics are heresy and blah blah blah. But I'm going to have it so that the main kingdom itself, magic is acceptable, because they accept that part of this world that they're in, magic is a byproduct of nature, or it's part of nature. And because as Muslim scholars, they have to learn more, so they learn how to harness it, how to shape it, and how to mold it. Thus, you know, they can fire a magic missile at a gazebo.
That's awesome. I had a really amazing conversation with a friend of mine named Osama Dorius. He lives in Montreal here in Canada. And he was talking about how he works in the video game industry. And he was talking about how there are very few really positive and fair representations of Muslims. And this is one in tabletop RPGs that you're developing. And that's really cool.
And it's not
that's like super
the,
cool.
It's not even the stereotypical Middle Eastern Muslims.
Yeah.
You know, like Southeast Asian Muslims.
Plus, yeah, others, which is so good.
There'll be Christians, and there'll be Jews, and there'll be people who are, you know, who are agnostic and atheist, and they'll all be accepted in the
right.
Wow, that is another added level of like value to A, the conversation, and to B, like the work that you're doing.
Yeah, right, yeah. I agree.
Now I've got a question for you, dude. So if the viewers want to follow you on this journey, on this project that you're doing, on this home game, and they want to, you know, promote your work, they want to support your work on Patreon, like, how can they find you on the internet?
Well, at the moment, the D&D world itself is, you know, it's like behind-the-scenes stuff, so it's not out yet, except for that one actual player report that I have on my blog.
Yeah.
The only place that you can find me is on my blog, which is www.hishgraphics.com. And I'm on Twitter, also hishgraphics.
And I think that's it, right?
Yeah, I'm off. I think that's it. I'm on.
Yeah, and you have your Patreon, of course.
Yeah, Patreon/hishgraphics.
Nice. You got all of the same ones. Good branding.
Yeah.
So for the audience, if you want to, you know, follow Kyril on Twitter, you want to support his work on Patreon, and you want to read his play reports, see his amazing artwork, and hear about all of the amazing educational things he's doing with gaming, follow him on all of those platforms at Hish Graphics.
That's H-I-S-H Graphics.
Dude, thank you so much. This was really awesome, and I'm glad we were able to sort out an interview with a time difference.
Yeah. It's just great talking to you both.
Yeah, and we want to follow up with you again when you have new projects, when you've got updates on the D&D thing.
Oh yeah,
we're so into it right now.
Yeah, and if you develop more about like the using RPGs as a teaching tool, definitely hit us up.
Right.
Yeah.
Will do. Oh, did you read my report about this last week?
No, I didn't.
So I had to teach English to a bunch of Malaysian army people.
Oh, I saw that. Was it that video that you posted?
Oh, no, it wasn't a video. It was a blog link, and they put me in one slot, and the slot said role play. You know. So I'm like,
oh, I see.
Cracking my knuckles, role play, okay. And I spent, a whole day, and I slept at 2 a.m. working on a hybrid card and role playing game.
So, cool.
What happened was we split the class into six teams, and then they had to learn speaking, right? They had to role play as a mission commander, and somebody had to role play as a squad leader. And when they had to draw cards from different decks, which I prototype, they're all written by hand, you know. And then there's the objective deck, and then there's a weather deck, there's a terrain deck, there's an insertion method deck. So they randomly get different conditions and situations for them. And at first, the commanding officer will have to give a briefing based on the cards that they drew. And
right.
Some of them, they role-played really well, you know. All they had was something like rescue prisoner of war, and then insertion method is helicopter, and then terrain is desert. And then they just go all out and saying that, you know, since we'll be going on a desert, we'll be using this gear and that gear and this camouflage uniform, and then since we're going by helicopter, and they're not talking to me, they have to give a briefing to their team. And since we're going by helicopter, we have to move, leave at 0200 hours, and we have to reach there at, you know, 0400 hours, and it's we have to reach there early because if the sun comes up, there'll be scorching heat in the desert, blah, blah, blah. And everything was made, you know, it's just like I had like a day to develop this game. And I thought that it went well. And, well, I was just happy with how the responded.
That's awesome. You wrote like a pseudo LARP, basically.
Yeah. And they had to roll a D20 because everything had a modifier and the objective card had a target number.
That's so cool. So this is basically like an almost like an informal military simulation exercise using RPG mechanics.
Played by actual military people.
Yeah, that's so cool. I actually got to play RPGs with the military this week for the game that I wrote. So like seeing you do this, this is like whole other level. That's so cool. Agatha and I just like scrolled through the blog post.
Oh, yeah, we saw that picture with the one
with the D20 on the floor. That's awesome.
They were like so, rolling the D20 and chasing it across the floor. What do we got?
So what we'll do for the listeners who, you know, who want to read about that, we're going to put a link to this specific blog post plus all of your other social media on the One Shot Network website.
Cool.
Kyril, thank you so much for agreeing to doing this episode.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for doing this. And we'll definitely talk again soon. For joining us for this episode of Asians Represent, and thank you, listener, for tuning in.
Asians Represent is a part of the One Shot Podcast Network. If you head to oneshotpodcast.com, you can listen to a variety of amazing podcasts like The Broadswords, an all-women actual play Dungeons & Dragons podcast focusing on roleplay, narrative, and diversity at the gaming table. If you have questions about today's theme, the games discussed, or anything else related to Asians Represent, get in touch with us on Twitter at AZNS Represent or at AZNS Represent at oneshotpodcast.com.
Yeah. And all of the show notes will be on oneshotpodcast.com. So all of Kyril's links, things that we love, will all be there. And with that being said, I'm Daniel.
And I'm Agatha.
And you've just listened to
Asians Represent!